I'm joined here today by Dr. Lee Levati. She is the Deputy Chief Medical Examiner for the Wayne County Medical Examiner's Office in Detroit, Michigan. She's also a Clinical Associate Professor of Pathology at the University of Michigan. Dr. Levati has graciously agreed to look at the autopsy report for Haman Lee, the autopsy photos, and the testimony by the medical examiner who conducted the autopsy. Now, before we start, a couple of caveats. First, the autopsy photos are black and white, they're not color, and they're fairly low resolution. And secondly, unfortunately, the state's file does not include any photos of the body when it was still buried and before it was disinterred. Okay, so with those caveats in place, let's go ahead and jump into some of these medical findings, and let's start with the process known as livor mortis. And so, Dr. Levati, can you please tell me about the process that is known as livor mortis?
Yes, livor mortis refers to the red-purple discoloration of the skin that you see on bodies after death. It is a physical process that occurs after death wherein the blood settles within the dependent areas of the body based on gravity. Meaning, if you die on your back and are left in that position, the blood will then settle into the back half of your body. It's a process that becomes visible or evident about 2 to 4 hours after death, and it can take up to 8 to 12 hours to become the most prominent or visible and to fix. Now, fixation happens when there is breakdown or hemolysis of the blood within the blood vessel that occurs after death. And so if a body is moved after lividity is fixed, the lividity will not shift and resettle into the new body position. So if the body that was on its back was then flipped onto its stomach after fixation, the lividity would remain on the back half of the body. Now, this 8 to 12 hours is merely just an estimate or a guide, because like all of the changes that happen to the body after death, it is very environmental and temperature dependent. And this guide of 8 to 12 hours was based on what they call temperate conditions, meaning about room temperature 60 to 80 degrees. So if the temperature is warmer than that, this time frame could be accelerated. And if the temperatures are colder, then the time frame could be even more delayed.
Okay, and the autopsy report for Haman Lee says that her body had fixed frontal lividity. Is that consistent with what you saw in the autopsy photos?
Well, the 5 black and white photos that I viewed of the body taken at the morgue, because they were black and white and because of the changes of decomposition and dirt that was left on the body in some of those photographs, honestly, I cannot tell the lividity pattern based on those photos alone. However, the report and the medical examiner testimony were very clear that this was anterior or frontal lividity. So knowing that and looking at the photos, there's no variation in the shading of gray from the left half of the body to the right half. So the photographs would therefore be consistent with fixed full frontal or anterior lividity.
Okay, and if we turn then to the state's theory of the case at trial, their claim is that Haman Lee was killed at 2:36 p.m. and thereafter pretzeled up in the trunk of her Nissan Sentra for the next 4 to 5 hours. Would that be consistent with the finding of fixed frontal lividity in this case?
No, absolutely not. To get fixed full frontal lividity, that would mean that the body would have to be face down and left in that position in a temperate location for up to 8 to 12 hours in order for the lividity to fix. If the body was put into the trunk of a vehicle or pretzeled up and then transported and then even buried on its right side within a 4 to 5 hour window, the lividity pattern on the body once it was disinterred would be consistent with the burial position, meaning it would be on the right side of the body. And that is not the case here.
And then also, as you were sort of mentioning, according to the autopsy report, when Haman Lee's body was found in Lincoln Park, she was found buried on her right side. And the state's contention at trial was that she was buried in Lincoln Park in the 7 o'clock hour based upon cell phone pings about 4 to 5 hours after death. Would that be consistent with a finding of fixed frontal lividity?
No. If she was indeed buried within 4 to 5 hours of death, again, considering a temperate location, then the lividity pattern would have fixed after burial, and it would have been on the right half of her body and not fully frontal.
Okay, so let's next turn to the process known as rigor mortis. And could you please describe to our audience the process known as rigor mortis?
Yeah, rigor mortis is the stiffening of the body's muscles that occurs after death. It's actually a chemical process that occurs to the body after death because the body is no longer able to make the ATP needed to break the actin-myosin complexes within muscle cells. I know that's a little too techy there for the audience, but it becomes evident about 2 to 4 hours after death, and it starts in the smaller muscle groups like the jaw, and then it will spread to the arms and the legs. It takes up to 8 to 12 hours to become fully developed. Fully developed means that the body is completely stiff. It will remain fully developed for about 8 to 12 hours, and then it will take an additional 8 to 12 hours to disappear or for the body to become flaccid again. And it will disappear in the same order of muscles as it appears. Now, if you happen to manipulate the body after rigor mortis is fully developed, meaning, say, you turn the head or you bend a limb, you break the rigor in that part of the body, and then that part of the body will go limp. And again, the time frame is just a guide. It is just as temperature dependent as lividity. And if it is really warm, the appearance and disappearance of the rigor mortis will be accelerated. And if it is significantly colder, then it will be delayed.
Okay, now in this case, Heyman Lee's body was found on February 9th, 1999. The state's claim that she was killed and buried on January 13th, 1999. And according to the state, when Lee's body was disinterred, her body still had some rigor, and that rigor was easily broken, probably due to temperature, according to the medical examiner. Now, if Lee had in fact been dead for almost a month before she was found, do these findings about rigor mortis make sense?
Well, the cold temperatures do complicate the estimate of time of death because it delays all of the changes that we see on the body and we use to make that estimate. And cold also does make the body stiff all by itself. I mean, the most extreme example of this would be freezing of the body if the temperature was cold enough. So in order to assess whether the stiffness is due to rigor mortis or the cold, we really need to consider the other changes we see on the body, namely those that are the evidence of decomposition. Decomposition is where the body starts to break down itself from the inside by the release of intracellular enzymes and the normal bacteria that is within your gut. And decomposition occurs after rigor mortis has passed. So we see skin slippage on the body, and skin slippage is something that happens in decomposition. So because we see evidence of decomposition, this means that the rigor mortis had to have already have been passed. And therefore, the stiffening that we see in the body has to be due to the cold temperatures. Frankly, nothing else makes sense.
Okay, and that takes us then, you mentioned skin slippage a bit. So if we're turning to skin slippage, yeah, if you could go into a little bit more detail about exactly what skin slippage is in a dead body.
Skin slippage is the sloughing of the superficial layers of the skin off of the body, and it occurs early in decomposition. In temperate conditions, usually around, it starts around the 2 to 3 day mark. And its appearance really is, it can be varied. It usually starts as the formation of what looks like a blister. And then when the roof of the blister ruptures, the skin then sloughs off the body. It can result in loss of pigmentation in someone who is dark-skinned because that pigment is in those superficial layers of the skin. And it can make the body surface that is left very slimy to the touch. Skin slippage happens at any point where there's contact with the body, whether it be someone physically moving the body or something in the environment contacting the body. So in a case like this, you would expect the skin to slough or slip off of the body simply because it was buried in a shallow grave. So any parts of the environment that the body would have been exposed to, like rocks, would have caused skin slippage. Also, the skin would slip from being disinterred or dug up, from being transported to the morgue, and then once at the morgue, being undressed, photographed, and examined. So all of this would be anytime something contacted the body, it would cause the skin to slough or slip off.
Okay, and so if we look to the autopsy report in this case, it notes that Lee had quote-unquote generalized skin slippage. And so after you looked at the black and white photos from the autopsy, what are your conclusions about the amount of skin slippage in this case?
I think that the amount and the distribution of the skin slippage on the body is exactly what you would expect for a body that was buried in a shallow grave for about 3 to 4 weeks and then disinterred and examined.
Okay, and so if we combine these three findings about lividity, rigor mortis, and skin slippage, what's your best guess overall about how much time passed between the death of Haman Lee and her burial?
Well, I think that there's two more things that we need to consider before estimating the time of death. One would be the burial of the body, and the other would be the examination of the brain. Burial itself delays all of the changes that occur after death that we've already talked about. There is a published rule of thumb that says that 1 week exposed to air is equal to about 8 weeks buried in dirt. And certainly my experiences here in Detroit have shown this to be actually pretty true. So that a body that's been buried for several weeks can resemble one that has been, say, dead in a house for only a few days. The other is the examination of the brain itself. In strangulation, the head gets congested and filled with blood because the pressure on the neck prevents the blood from draining from the head. So ordinarily, in strangulation victims who are starting to decompose, the head actually decomposes at a slightly faster rate than the rest of the body. And thus, if that was the case, the brain would not appear normal and have a good demarcation between its gray and white matter structures as this one did. So, based on the fact that this is full fixed frontal lividity, that the rigor mortis had passed, that we're seeing general skin slippage in a body that was buried in cold temperatures and internally did not show evidence of decomposition, I think that this was a body that was left face down for up to 8 to 12 hours before it was buried, and that she was buried with likely within 8 to 24 hours of her death.
Okay, and let's next turn to the topic of pulmonary edema. What exactly is a pulmonary edema?
Pulmonary edema is this frothy, white or pink proteinaceous fluid that is within the lungs, and it does contain some red blood cells, thus giving it its pink color. But it is a non-specific autopsy finding. There are certainly certain types of deaths in which you are more apt to see pulmonary edema. Most notably, these would be opiate narcotic drug deaths, or people dying of heart disease in which they're dying in heart failure. But it can be seen in any type of death, and that would include strangulation.
Okay, now in this case, there was a T-shirt with stains that was found by the driver's seat in Lee's Nissan Sentra. The state's claim at trial was that a strangulation caused Lee to have a pulmonary edema, and they claim that this can cause this foamy blood to come out of the victim's mouth and nose right after death. They also claim that whoever killed Lee likely then used that T-shirt to wipe away this foamy blood from Lee's nose and mouth after strangling her. Do you think that's a likely scenario in this case?
Well, unless pulmonary edema was produced as part of the mechanism of death, such as respiratory failure in opiate death, it usually doesn't just spontaneously froth up and emanate out of the nose and mouth. But when a body dies, it loses all of its muscle tone. So any fluid that is within the body, whether it be urine, pulmonary edema, or stomach contents, these can be expelled from the body if the body is placed in a dependent position. Meaning if someone was strangled and then after they died, they're tilted forward or perhaps placed prone on their stomach, certainly the fluid that would be within the lungs could then leak from the nose and mouth. It's also possible that during the initial struggle, before the pressure could be tightly maintained on her neck and she was still alive and conscious, that she was coughing or gagging during this process. And in that, she could have produced a mucousy blood-tinged fluid that could have escaped through her mouth.
Okay, now in this case, the state tested the T-shirt and they determined that the stains on the T-shirt tested positive for the presence of blood. They didn't do additional testing, though. And so were there additional tests the state could have done to determine whether, in fact, these stains were the result of this frothy blood from a pulmonary edema?
Not that I'm aware of.
Let's turn next to the finding in the autopsy report about hemorrhages. And so according to the autopsy report, she had a focal right temporalis muscle hemorrhage, and she also had a focal right occipital subgaleal hemorrhage. And so what do those two things mean?
Well, the temporalis muscle hemorrhage is a bruise in the muscle that is located above your right ear that is visible after your scalp is reflected. So it's a muscle that's located between your scalp and your skull. And the right occipital subgale hemorrhage is a bruise that is actually on the undersurface of the scalp itself, on the right back of the head. As to what these mean, we have to think again about the lividity pattern in the head, because when blood pools in the scalp due to body position, it can sometimes mimic the subscalp hemorrhages. In this case, because this is full frontal anterior lividity, these bruises on the right side and the right back of her head mean that these are two blunt force impacts to her head that she sustained while she was alive.
Okay, and obviously you don't have the full evidence to be able to see the extent of these hemorrhages, but based upon the description in the autopsy report, do you think these hemorrhages are consistent with blows that could have rendered Lee either stunned or unconscious?
Yes, it is possible that she could have been momentarily stunned or rendered unconscious with one or either of these blows.
Okay, now when the state made its closing argument, they claimed that Lee was actually in the passenger seat of her Nissan Sentra, her assailant was in the driver's seat, and that the hemorrhages could have been caused when she was being strangled in the passenger seat as her head hit against the passenger side window of the Nissan Sentra. How likely do you think that scenario is?
It is possible. I know the head has a greater range of motion in relation to the torso. But if she's sitting in the passenger seat, that certainly either the door, the window, or the dash, she could have, her head could have been hit against those structures and caused both of those impacts to her head.
Okay, and if we go with the alternate scenario of, well, maybe she was in the driver's seat of the Nissan Sentra, how likely do you think it is that the hemorrhages could have been the result from someone sitting in the passenger seat and punching her in the head?
That scenario is just as likely. She also could have, while in the driver's seat, have turned her head and could have hit the steering wheel or the dash as well. But either of those two scenarios, based on the location of these impacts, could be possible.
And again, we don't have full information about, again, the size of the hemorrhages or pictorial evidence, but if you sort of look at the description again, do you think these hemorrhages are more consistent with punches or more consistent with someone being struck or having their head striking some type of blunt instrument or weapon?
Well, there's no external injuries to the head, so these are hemorrhages that are underneath the scalp. So this would indicate that a broad, flat object struck her head, and either a fist or an open hand or something like the window, door, or dash would fit that description.
Okay, then I have one final question. It's about the actual act of strangulation in this case. And so in this case, the state had a pretty tight timeline because they were trying to claim to the jury during closing argument that in the immediate aftermath of school, Lee was taken to a Best Buy and was strangled in the parking lot before her assailant made a phone call from the Best Buy payphone at 2:36 p.m. And as part of the case made to the jury during closing argument, the state said that her murderer strangled Lee for about 10 seconds, producing death. Is that consistent or inconsistent with your understanding of the time that it takes to fatally strangle someone?
That is definitely inconsistent. Strangulation is a multi-step process that takes several minutes of pressure on the neck in order to result in death. First, there's the period of struggle, where the grip on the neck cannot be constantly or tightly maintained. Now, admittedly, the length of this struggle is going to differ in each case and is thus unknown. and that's because it will depend on the size and the strength of the victim and the assailant, whether or not the victim was restrained in any way, and then or whether the victim was incapacitated either by any trauma, any drugs in their system, or by any underlying medical condition. Now, in this case, the two blunt force impacts to her head could have incapacitated her and thus shortened this struggle period. But eventually, in all strangulation cases, the victim is overwhelmed, and then the pressure on the neck can and is maintained tightly and constantly because it stops the blood flow coming back from the head, and it deprives the brain cells of oxygenated blood. And consciousness is usually lost within seconds, although it's usually under 30 seconds. 10 is really a sort of arbitrary number. After consciousness is lost, the pressure then has to be maintained tightly and constantly for an additional 2 to 3 minutes in order for death to occur, as that's how long your brain cells can last without oxygen before they die. So if pressure was placed on the neck and then released after loss of consciousness, the victim will regain consciousness on their own. There are studies out there in the literature about near strangulation victims that support this. Now, clearly there is a point of no return where the centers of your brain that control your heart rate and your breathing are affected by the lack of oxygen, and resuscitation is needed in order to prevent death. But this point of return is variable because it will depend on each person and is thus unknown. But these near strangulation studies support that that point of no return is much closer to the minute's end than the second's end.
Hey, Dr. Levati, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate all of the expert insight.
You are quite welcome, and thank you for sharing such a fascinating case with me.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.